This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Julian Morrow. Welcome to The Roundtable.
I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and on behalf of the Australian Labor Party, I commit to the Uluru Statement from the Heart in full.
That was the very first commitment that Anthony Albanese made as Prime Minister-elect in his victory speech on the 21st of May. The Uluru Statement from the Heart was released about 5 years ago on the 26th of May 2017 by the delegates to the First Nations National Constitutional Convention. Here's what Mr. Albanese went on to say.
We can answer its patient, gracious call for a voice enshrined in our Constitution.
So today on the Roundtable, we'll explore what that commitment to implement the patient gracious invitation of the Uluru Statement from the Heart means and the political opportunities and challenges that lie ahead. And to do that, we're joined by the Deputy Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at University of New South Wales, Dr. Dani Larkin. Welcome, Dani.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Great to have you. Dani is part of the team behind the Uluru Dialogue. We're also joined by Greens Senator from Western Australia, Dorinda Cox. Welcome, Dorinda.
Morning, how are you?
Very well indeed, and it certainly is the morning where you are. Thanks very much for joining us. Dorinda, of course, a proud Yamaji Noongar woman. And we're also joined by Rosalind Dixon, Professor of Law, also from the University of New South Wales. Welcome, Ros.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you all. But I'd like to start the roundtable today by doing something a little bit different to begin with, because I think that as we discuss implementing the Uluru Statement, it's good to be reminded of exactly what that statement from the heart is. So we're going to take a few minutes now to hear the Uluru Statement from the Heart, read by Pat Anderson, Stan Grant, Adam Goods, Ursula Jovich and Troy Cassadaly in an arrangement by Midnight Oil.
We, gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart.
Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago.
This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land, or Mother Nature, and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown.
How could it be otherwise? The peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia, and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood.
Proportionately, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alienated from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for our future.
These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds and their culture will be a gift to their country.
We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination.
We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement making between governments and First Nations and truth telling about our history.
In 1967, we were counted.
In 2017, we seek to be heard.
We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future.
Yes, that is the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And as the Prime Minister said, it's a generous invitation and one that has required, yet again, patience from Indigenous Australians since it was made back in 2017. But the new Labor government is now committed to the Uluru Statement from the Heart in full. So what does that mean? Dr. Dani Larkin, if I could start with you. Every Australian Prime Minister since, well, I think going all the way back to John Howard, but Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull, Scott Morrison, maintained a commitment to constitutional recognition. You're a senior representative of the Uluru Dialogue leadership team. Why does constitutional enshrinement come first in the Uluru Statement?
Thanks for your question. Look, it comes first for a variety of different reasons, but I think ultimately, you know, the view from dialogue participants who participated in the regional dialogues and the Uluru Convention back in 2017 was that it was about us being able to, through a mechanism like a First Nations national representative body, to be able to have a say on laws and policies that pass through the government and parliament, ones that, you know, directly, indirectly impact First Nations affairs. And so the view there was about, you know, ensuring that we set up the right mechanism to do those types of things. There was a real urgency that dialogue participants had observed with their discussions and debates that were had throughout that process on getting these things right when it comes to First Nations law reform. But most importantly, it was about ensuring that prior to taking steps to progressing with really important processes like treaty, agreement making, and truth telling, that we had the right adequate amount of political legitimacy and constitutional standing through enshrinement of a representative body of this kind to go about ensuring that we have the right resources available to us and, you know, the right amount of self-determination opportunity in parliament and government to ensure that those processes are guided by mob and are done so through self-determination.
And in part, Dani, is that informed by the history of attempts to have representative institutions with the national parliament and executive governments chopping and changing the models over the years?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we always come back to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission and the National Congress, right, as clear examples of, you know, what our issue is. And, you know, when it comes to national Indigenous representative bodies, they're either established as a independent corporation but still reliant on government funding to achieve their objectives, or they're established through ordinary legislation. And what happens is the moment those bodies, you know, have a disagreement or challenge the views of the government of the day, it's not long after that they're extinguished, and it's either through repeal of their establishing extraordinary legislation or, you know, funding's cut to those bodies so that they're unable to achieve their objectives. And so there was a recognition of that, an acknowledgement of that in the dialogue process. And from there, it was about, and with the constitutional, you know, reform recognition question always on the table throughout that entire time, you know, dialogue participants had gone, well, maybe then we seek constitutional recognition through constitutional protection, enshrinement of a voice to Parliament that would perform the functionality of past bodies of what they've done in the past in advising on law and policy reform, but they're protected so they can't be extinguished, taken away by the whim of the government of the day.
Yeah, so constitutional enshrinement, of course, will provide protection, but it also creates a high bar for implementation. Professor Rosalind Dixon, there have been 44 referendum questions in Australia since Federation, over 19 ballots. Only 8 referendum questions have got up. So it's a pretty challenging process. What is the formal process from here for achieving that constitutional enshrinement?
Well, Julian, I think it's very much still up for negotiation what the exact timing and sequencing is. But, you know, formally it requires legislation and then it requires a majority of electors in a majority of states, which means building a broad national consensus in favour. But I think it is important to say, you know, big ideas are going to motivate people to pay attention and understand the proposal. Some of those 44 have been big ideas, but some of them have been pretty technocratic.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to focus on the fact that it has to be a clear and understandable proposal, and people have to be brought along and explained in the way that Dani has so, you know, powerfully explained why it's important for First Nations to see the change. And then, of course, if you can get bipartisan support, that'll help. But I think it's right to say that it's really about convincing a broad swath of the community and then, you know, bringing them to the table on a sensible and clear proposal that makes sense in terms of history and the call of people at Uluru for change.
It's interesting that you mention both timing and sequencing. Senator Dorinda Cox, what is the Greens' position in relation to a referendum on a voice to Parliament? And is the Greens' view different in terms of that question of sequencing of implementing voice, treaty and truth-telling?
Look, our policy is different in the way that it prioritises truth and treaty before voice. We think that, I mean, practically that's already happening in the state of Victoria with their Treaty Commission, and they've started with truth-telling. So you know, the information and the work that we've done within our party through our First Nations network has been to establish that sequence, which we believe will allow us to continue to support Labor in their venture to establish the Makarrata Commission, which I know Senator Pat Dodson put a motion to the floor last February, which unfortunately was voted down. But you know, I don't think that there's a priority in just being the voice. I think we can do these simultaneously. And I did hear Linda Burney talk about this, that there's an opportunity for us to work on all three of those simultaneously. I don't think we need to choose about what's the priority in that. And we also have other work that's already on the floor. So, you know, in the Senate, there's already the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples motion, which Lydia Thorpe put forward in February, which I co-signed. So there are other pieces of work that we also need to do around structural reform. And so that's already the work of the day.
Do you think, Dorinda Cox, that the Greens would stand in the way of the voice being the first part of the Uluru Statement, which is implemented?
No, I think that our portfolio holder, who is Senator Lydia Thorpe from Victoria, has been very clear that we need to see the detail in that. We won't stand in the way of a referendum. That is not what, you know, the work that we do in the Senate. We will work alongside all parties and to work to looking at the detail and seeing what that is. But I think that, you know, we do have to be clear that there is lots of work that's already there that is already commenced, but we will never stand in the way of progress of Indigenous affairs in this country.
It's interesting. I mean, the Prime Minister's commitment to implementing the Uluru Statement is certainly definitive, he says in full, but the detail of exactly how that what might happen is, as you point out, not really fleshed out, at least from the government so far. Dr. Dani Larkin, how developed is thinking about what question should be asked in a referendum, both within the Indigenous community or within the Labor government? Is the question sort of pinned down already?
Look, there's been a lot of work over the last 5 years, particularly done by the Indigenous Law Centre at UNSW, who work in partnership, consultation continuously with constitutional law experts across the country, but most importantly, dialogue delegates who participated in the Uluru Dialogue and Statement from the Heart. I think, you know, there's been work around it, but further consultation's going to need to be had. So that's, you know, a natural part of, you know, setting a date for a referendum and then kick-starting a campaign for that, right? So there'll have to be, you know, educational support that's rolled out in a really comprehensive way across the country to all Australians. There's going to have to be further consultation and deeper meaningful consultation with First Nations people across the country, those views who weren't that weren't captured in the initial part of this process and the regional dialogues are certainly going to be prioritised in a process like this heading towards a referendum. Those views are really important and they count. And so, but it'll come down from, you know, it'll have to come from MOB as to what those details are. This is all about creating a voice that's for MOB, that's designed by MOB. And so that's going to have to come, you know, later in the process. But there's certainly been work in terms of the question and, you know, potential constitutional wording as to what this reform might look like and how it might be inserted in the constitution. Yes, that's been done. There was an amazing piece that was written in the Indigenous Constitutional Law blog and by Professor Megan Davis and Professor Gabrielle Appleby and Associate Professor Sean Brennan. And they've looked at, you know, how, well, what are the three core things that you need? And ultimately, this reform must establish the First Nations voice as an enduring form of recognition for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. It must describe and protect its primary function of conveying the views of First Nations people to the Parliament and government in the development of policies and laws that affect them. But it also must empower Parliament to legislate the detailed design of the First Nations voice and make necessary amendments over time to adapt to changing circumstances for it.
Ros Dixon, in terms of you referred to preparing the Australian people for implementing the Uluru Statement, for that purpose, is there some merit, do you think, to sort of deferring the detailed consideration of the sorts of questions that Dani was just describing so that the constitutional question is something simply like, should there be a constitutional a voice to Parliament?
Look, I think, Julian, there's lots of work that's been done of the kind that Dani says, and I think having given people some familiarity with that background work will be helpful, but clear and simple questions are always going to be better on a referendum ballot than screeds and screeds that ordinary people find hard to digest. So, you know, I've also done some work supporting that, you know, excellent work that Dani mentioned, and in all of that, you know, we've emphasised you need to set out the key principles that are going to guide the process, but the detail can wait for legislation. So, yeah, I think that that's absolutely right, and there's been a lot of work done to try and come up with different variants of what are clear but simple terms for a referendum question supported by a broader set of materials if people need and want to understand them.
Do you think the Indigenous community is better prepared for dealing with this question than the community more broadly, Dorinda Cox?
The community, I mean, what you know, what has been very clear is that the Uluru Statement from the Heart was developed through those regional dialogues, as Dani did say. Mm. And I think what we do know is that they were all by invitation. So I think that there has to be a national dialogue, both with MOB, but also more broadly, and I agree with that process, because what we haven't done is enable our people to see that there is a vision around constitutional recognition and what that means. And that's the detail that's required. What we also need to do is make sure that the government are prioritising some of the more tangible actions that they can be doing right now in order to bring people on that journey around closing the gap, you know, the justice system, caring for country and other bits and pieces, because we can't just go for one thing. We absolutely have to do things that matter, to, particularly to people who are out in front line or at grassroots in their movements and fighting for country and fighting for their lives. In I can't put it any other way, but these are the things that are priority for mob who are out there. So to switch that narrative away from that is going to take a lot. And in fact, I think that we need to be, as I said, simultaneously dealing with all of those issues so that we can make sure we are bringing everybody on the journey with us.
Yes, indeed. There's certainly work to be done on more than one front. The incoming Indigenous Affairs Minister, Linda Burney, has said she doesn't want to rush this. In April, the Uluru Dialogue issued the Yarrabah affirmation, putting forward two possible referendum dates, the 27th of May 2023, which is the 56th anniversary of the 1967 referendum, or the 27th of January 2024, the day after Australia Day. Dani Larkin, do you think either of those Yarrabah dates are likely to be when the referendum happens?
I mean, I think, you know, the aspiration from Dialogue delegates who attended that Yarrabah affirmation, you know, they put those dates out there for a reason, and it's about timing. So, you know, we see timing as a really important thing. There's an urgency for this, and there's a clear consensus, you know, even from the submissions part of the co-design process that was rolled out last year by Minister Ken Wyatt, of the need for, you know, a referendum to be timetabled urgently. But I agree with, you know, Linda Burney's comments and her concerns. I think, you know, it's just, and I sort of pick up on what Senator Cox has said, with, you know, ensuring that we roll out the right process, the right consultative process to ensure that all Australians are brought along for this ride. They're educated, they're well informed, they're reassured as to how this body might function, exactly what it might look like. I mean, a lot of this type of work was done last year. You know, obviously these types of processes are iterative processes. They're not done perfectly the first time round. And you try and do your best in learning from, you know, what's gone wrong or what limitations or constraints you had at the time. And you try and make things better moving forward. And that's certainly the view that we have. I think those dates, look, they are soon. I think, you know, at the very least, looking at even early 2024 is great. But I think the meaning behind putting dates of that kind and their significance forward is about relaying that urgency and knowing that referendums rely on timing to be successful. And we've done a hell of a lot of polling over the last few years. We've got clear figures to show that there's Australian support across the country on this, and we're going to continue to try and increase that and improve it. But, you know, we do need to start thinking about dates for a potential referendum so that a campaign can get kick-started as soon as possible.
You've mentioned a couple of times, Dani, that that concept of co-design of what the voice to Parliament actually looks like. Professor Rosalind Dixon, what are the sort of options on the table in terms of what a voice to Parliament might look like? Is it likely to be, for example, a body which is directly elected?
I think, Julian, that will be one of the questions that has to be figured out in the kind of process that Dani talks about. Mm. And I think there will be, you know, broad principles set out. But again, it will vary. Different mobs are going to have different ways of thinking about the relationship between elders and election and different notions of, you know, traditional representation. So that's part of the, you know, the genius of the model, which is the principles will be set out, but the details can be figured out and adjusted by legislation. And I think it is important that when we talk about these issues, you know, we could have a conceptual debate about, you know, what's the best order or what's the best model, but it is actually about recognising Indigenous self-determination. And so some of these questions really do have to be settled by First Nation peoples in the way that Dani has said. And, you know, I think the Greens' position has lots of merit and logic to it, but it is also important to underscore the depth of the process and consultation that went into Uluru and the, you know, voice treaty truth ordering. And, you know, I spend a lot of time living in the United States, and I'm always mindful of there's no perfect timing, but you've got to seize momentum when it's there. You know, Nancy Pelosi took Barack Obama aside and was like, we've got to get this healthcare stuff done while there's still the momentum behind it. And, you know, it's really his biggest achievement, the Affordable Care Act. And so I feel like there is urgency. And yes, there's lots of priorities, but we need to hear the calls that were made 5 years ago and say, look, voice was at the top. You could logically argue it a whole bunch of different ways, but, you know, First Nation peoples have spoken and there's a clear case logically, intellectually for it. It makes sense. It's, you know, it's got popular First Nation and broader Australian support. So I think there is real urgency and we've got to do the further consultation, but we don't need to get bogged down on the details.
How important is the position of the Liberal Party going to be in terms of whether a referendum on constitutional enshrinement of a voice actually has a chance of success? Dorinda Cox, can you actually see there being bi or tripartisan support for a referendum question?
I think we could definitely see bipartisan, particularly across the Greens and now the incoming Labor government. And I can only speak for the Senate, obviously, because that's where I am. What I think the Liberal Party will do, I don't know. Again, we don't have the detail to be able to make a decision on that. We have to wait until that comes to the Senate and there's further conversation. As I said, you know, they're quite significant inquiries that have already triggered. Myself and Lydia Thorpe, ones on the missing and murdered Indigenous women and children in this country, and the first of its kind, you know, quite likened to what they did in Canada, and the conversations that we had with Canadian senators around their C-15 bill to domesticate the UNDRIP. So these are the two pieces of work that Lydia and I have taken forward into the Senate in order to start this process, in order to get people familiar with the detail of what's required when we talk about change, particularly for Indigenous people in this country. And so, you know, I do believe that we do need the data. We need to have some understanding because no one in the, you know, there's an expectation that people will vote for this. They need to actually understand what that means because they have to relay that. They have to be clear about what they're voting for. And I think that there's still a considerable amount of work for us to be able to do that. So, you know, I don't know the position of the Liberal Party. I have spoken to Minister Wyatt or, you know, Ken Wyatt before he left around this. And we do have a caucus across parties for our Indigenous MPs. So we, I think, we'll continue those conversations now that we have such a large number of us coming into the 47th
Certainly
Parliament.
Are boosted numbers coming into the next Parliament. Unfortunately, we've only got a couple of minutes. There's just so much that needs to be addressed in this whole process. Just finally, Dr. Dani Larkin, how optimistic are you about the chances of bi or tripartisan agreement on a voice through a referendum?
Yeah, look, I think I'm very optimistic. I think, you know, just looking at the amount of Liberal senators who have stepped up and, you know, listened to what First Nations calls are and have really, I mean, like Andrew Bragg's a clear example of that, right? Mm. And there's others that exist within the party as well. I think, you know, the momentum's there, the urgency's there. I think the support's there. I think, you know, the more as, you know, just listening to Dorinda speak, the more we can kind of continue this type of meaningful, deeper consultative process and keep fine-tuning those details as we go and roll out, you know, a decent yes campaign once a date's been set for a referendum. I think, you know, that'll just continue to grow the support and increase, you know, the likelihood of a successful referendum. So I'm very optimistic. I think the time is now and history is calling.
It is indeed, as is the 10 o'clock news, so we'll have to keep this quite brief. But Rosalind Dixon, are you confident that not only will there be a referendum, but that we'll actually see a voice existing during this term of Parliament?
I'm like Dani, I'm optimistic. I don't think you can be confident about change. You have to take every vote seriously and, you know, you can't take it for granted, whether it's consulting with mob or getting the Australian people off, over the line. But I definitely am optimistic in the way that Dani articulates.
And thanks very much to all our roundtable guests. Deputy Director of the Indigenous Law Centre at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Dani Larkin, Dorinda Cox, Greens Senator for West Australia, and Professor Rosalind Dixon, also of the University of New South Wales. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Julian Morrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.